This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next topic is recurrent focal glomerulosclerosis. As some of you know, this has been my long-term hobby. And I think the past few years, whenever my wife said, well, when are you going to retire, I always felt safe to say that, well, when we either understand recurrent focal, find the solution or the cure. So last year there was a paper that came out in Nature Medicine that, and I knew I would get a pass because it's not going to happen. And then last year there was a paper in Nature Medicine that heralded that the circulating factor of FSGS was discovered and it's super. So my wife pointed out, said, okay, your time is out. So I said, as you can see at the end of my talk, not yet. as many of you are, you know, quite well know that FSGS is an important cause of kidney disease, and it can be either idiopathic or secondary to many etiologies. About the majority of patients, over 80%, have the idiopathic variety of FSGS, and familial causes account maybe to a fifth of the cases. And these are due to the mutation of the so-called podocyte protein, the structural protein of the skeleton of the podocytes, including nephrin, podocin, actinin 4, CD2, AP, and PCLE2, and one of the more recent one, which I found very interesting, the TRPC6. So the majority of patients, though, do not seem to have these mutations. And nowadays, the food process of the podocyte is not our, what I would call it, our grandfather podocyte. It's not like a little food process sort of sitting with little activity. It has, first of all, in terms of structures, all these important skeletal proteins. It has receptors, as I said, like the TRC6 that's important in calcium flux. It has a angiotensin type 1 receptor. Of course, there is a cytoskeleton of myosin and actin. And the adapter proteins, such as synaptopodin, and, of course, the anchoring of the podocyte on the base membrane that depends on the beta integrins. Now, FSGS, obviously, is an important cause of glomerular disease, and about 1,500 patients every year get transplanted with a certain diagnosis of FSGS. Now, there may be more patients, but at least those that have documented by biopsy FSGS. And there are various glomerular manifestations of FSGS, from the tip lesion to the collapsing variety that may be more associated with a greater risk of recurrence. Now, the therapeutic intervention of FSGS have been confined to what I would call gross immune modulation, meaning high-dose steroids, cyclosporin, anti-proliferative agents, and even more recently, rituximab. Although, frankly, there has never been any evidence, concrete evidence, that this is an immunologic-mediated disease. But now, in fact, we know the mechanism of action of these drugs, there may be another reason why these drugs have been partially effective in FSGS that has nothing to do with their main mechanism of action on the immune system. I think within a decade, usually over 50% of patients with a diagnosis of FSGS end up in end-stage renal disease. Now, in 1972 in The Lancet, the first four cases of so-called idiopathic nephrotic syndrome were reported by the group in Minnesota, and these patients recurred right away with nephrosis. Some of them lost their kidney right away. And it's from there that this concept arose that there must be a circulating factor, because this happened very quickly. And the evidence only grew with time. One is that recurrence can occur within hours of transplantation with a patient having proteinuria. Number two, that you can actually induce remission with plasmapheresis by removing whatever is in circulation. And most recently, another experiment of nature is at the University of Chicago. And this is what happened, that this this lady here donated her kidney to her brother who had FSGS. He had prompt recurrence with about 35 grams of protein. They phoresed him. Nothing happened. Both of them got concerned that he was going to lose the kidney, and they didn't want to see the kidney go to waste. So Lorenzo Gallone, their nephrologist, they asked him whether they could remove his kidney and put it in somebody else who did not have FSGS. I remember I was in Cabo. I got a phone call from Lorenzo. They had biopsied the kidney, and it had only effacement of the foot processes, but it was still losing like 35 grams. And his question was, "What would I expect that the kidney would completely recover?" And my answer was yes, and that's because of our previous studies. And in fact, that's what they did. They removed this kidney from this patient here, transplanted in this gentleman here, and within days the proteinuria came down, and then when they rebiopsied the patient, the foot processes were completely normal, and the patient continues to have normal renal function. So, you know, this is a unique experiment. Again, it really typifies the nature of the host environment vis-a-vis the recurrence. Now, there's been also good experimental evidence of a factor. One, that if you take rats and you infuse them with the sera of patients with recurrent focal, you can induce proteinuria. This is not a model that is easily reproducible, but some people have shown that to occur. The other is that there are bioassays whereby you can demonstrate that you can increase permeability of the capillary when you add the sera of patients with FSGS. And finally, the paper that was recently published, I'll come to that in a minute, that suPAR is the circulating factor. Now, the treatment for recurrent focal, and some of these treatments also apply to focal in the native kidney, has been to use cyclosporin. And it wasn't clear why it would work. It's clearly, at one point, it was felt to be because of the immune effect on T cells. But in fact, now there is pretty good evidence is that cyclosporin acts on the acting cytoskeleton of the podocytes. And the data shows that the beneficial effect of cyclosporin on proteinuria is not dependent on the typical calcineurin effect on the transcription factor MFAT, but in fact, cyclosporin blocks the degradation of synaptopodin, and synaptopodin is an important regulator of the so-called GTPases. Now, the GTPases are the master regulator of the cytoskeleton of the podocytes, and there are three of them, and it is their balance of the three that maintains the foot process in a discrete way, and when there is imbalance between the three, you get effacement of the podocytes. So this represents a different view of how cyclosporin in fact works and may have nothing to do with its immune function. Plasmapheresis has been the classic way to treat patients with recurrent focal. It was first shown by Zimmerman. Then we did a large number of studies that we published many years ago showing exactly how it works and how many number of phoresis one needs to do. And this is when we had a fellow from Italy who had done her training with us, Mary Artero. And we looked at all our cases of FSGS. We did show that the main risk for recurrence was related to time of diagnosis to end-stage renal disease. And secondly, that it didn't make a difference whether the patient received a living donor or cadaver kidney. Now, this is a typical patient who had recurrence of FSGS with proteinuria. We did 9 plasmapheresis because as we were sampling the urine protein, we noticed that it takes at least 5 to get the protein down. The protein went down and then relapsed again. We did another apheresis, and this time the patient responded, and gradually the proteinuria went down and the patient continued to have normal function. And what we did, in those days, we used to biopsy the patient who had right away, as we do now, right away when they have proteinuria, we biopsy them. And this is the food process is completely effaced. When we apheresed them and the proteinuria went into remission, the podocyte came back in a very discrete manner. In this patient, when he recurred again, we biopsied him again, and again the food processes fused, and then after the second remission, we did another biopsy, and the podocyte went back to normal. I mean, we did that in a bunch of patients when, at that point, we stopped doing it because we got convinced that these changes are completely and totally reversible early on. And then we collaborated with Virginia Savin, who had a nice bioassay whereby she isolated the glomerulus from a rat kidney and put it in a medium of 5 grams of bovine serum albumin. And then while under observation, she decreased the oncotic pressure around the glomerulus so that fluid went from outside to inside the glomerulus and the glomerulus swelled. And if there was the sera of a patient with a recurrent focal, there was increase in permeability and the protein from within glomerulus went out, and therefore you would not see the increase in the volume. And we could actually quantitate that and report it as a permeability of albumin. So anything over 0.5 was suggestive of the presence of this factor. And in fact, in this paper, we showed that after apheresis, the permeability factor activity went down as well as the proteinuria. The problem has been the bioassay is difficult to reproduce very easily, and people have used it to try to narrow the range of proteins or factors in circulation that could be the cause. But at the end of the day, many of the labs end up with normal proteins components in the blood. So it hasn't been as helpful in determining what is the circulating factor. Next came rituximab, and this was a letter to the editor published in New England Journal, a patient post-transplant who had recurrent focal but also had developed PTLD. They gave the patient rituximab to get rid of the PTLD, and the focal sclerosis went away. And so there were several other reports of interest with rituximab. And however, at UCSF, we had two cases that were well studied, had only fusion of podocytes very early, did not respond to apheresis. We gave them rituximab and nothing happened. We depleted their B cells. And then we found two cases that were treated similarly at Stanford. And I think these cases, just like this and this one, convinced me that rituximab did not really have much of an effect. However, we always consider rituximab as doing something to B cells, and maybe somehow the B cells are involved. But in fact, there is recent literature that if rituximab works, it may be because its effect on the podocyte cytoskeleton. And I think there are still reports, maybe more in children than adult, in the native kidney, that in some patients, rituximab could be effective. But again, this is not through B cell depletion. It's probably through direct effect on the cytoskeleton. And finally, another approach is to produce complete blockade of the renin-angiotensin system. Now, why would that work? Well, the TRPC6 is an important flow for the flow of calcium intracellularly. And angiotensin II inhibitors block the flow of calcium. It looks like, at least in vitro, an increased flow of calcium can destabilize the myosin actin fibers. And therefore, A2 inhibition may have a beneficial effect and decreasing progression from its effect on the on this a specific area of the podocytes. And in fact, in this case of recurrent focal, where the patient was treated with apheresis and rituximab and everything, and then patient continued to have proteinuria, when they achieved complete renin blockade with aliskiren, A2 inhibition, and ARB inhibition, that the proteinuria came down and stayed down. I have tried this in one or two patients. Frankly, I have not been impressed that it works. But I think it gives you an idea as to why angiotensin inhibitors or ARBs can play a role in patients who have focal sclerosis or where podocyte abnormalities can occur because they inhibit the flow of calcium in the podocyte. So the search for biomarker for recurrent FSGS has persisted until last year when a very high-profile paper was published in Nature Medicine. I told Peggy I wanted a picture of a dawn because maybe this is a dawn of understanding of recurrent focal. Circulating urokinase as a cause of focal glomerulosclerosis. Now, in this article, they identified UPAR, the urokinase plasminogen activator, which is this one, which is a glycosylated protein consisting of three domains that has a GPI anchor to the cell membrane but doesn't have an intracellular tail, so it doesn't induce any signaling. However, it mediates its effect by binding to various ligands. One of the ligands is the urokinase plasminogen activator, which is important, in the degeneration of the extracellular matrix, in migration, and probably plays an important role in metastasis. For us, in terms of our interest in podocytes, the interaction of UPAR with the beta-3 integrin plays an important role in the activation of factors that play an important role in the food processes. So UPAR can be either in circulation, and that's how we refer to it as SUPAR, or can be membrane-bound as UPAR. So this is a schema of the hypothesis of how SUPAR or UPAR induces food process effacement. So SUPAR binds to the beta-3 integrin on the surface of cell membrane and leads to activation of two out of three GTPases. Now, the GTPases are basically important. These three GTPases are important markers for the food processes. These are enzymes that turn on or off signaling processes or proteins. And the food processes require a sort of like an equilibrium between these three to remain to continue to have integrity. If you have too much, the basal production of RhoA promotes the formation of stress fibers and produces a stationary phenotype, meaning the podocytes are normal. If you have activation of CDC42 and RAC1, you trigger polymerization of the fibrils, which leads to cell motility and effacement of the food processes. So the hypothesis is SUPAR binds to beta-3, activates disproportionately these two GTPases, and this leads to downstream signaling that leads to effacement of the food processes. So this group started to look at SUPAR level. The main author of this study was Joachim Reiser and found that it was elevated in patients with primary FSGS, but not in other conditions that have proteinuria. And then compared patients with primary FSGS, non-recurrent FSGS, and recurrent, and found that the recurrent ones had significantly higher SUPAR than those who did not recur. And again, here you can see the recurrent much higher than non-recurrent. So basically, pointed the finger to SUPAR as a biomarker. But they went beyond that to show that, in fact, not only is a biomarker, but plays a role in FSGS. These are the patients that had high SUPAR level, underwent plasmapheresis, and as you can see, those who responded to with the proteinuria coming down, their SUPAR levels came down. These two patients did not respond, and the SUPAR level continued to be elevated. This is a series of very elegant studies in the mouse. First of all, we said that SUPAR mechanism of action is through activation of beta-3. And one can detect activation of beta-3 with an antibody to an activation epitope on its surface called AP5. So you can see FSGS have elevated AP5. So they took mice and infused them with with Supar and could produce proteinuria. When they did the same thing but treated the mouse with an anti-Supar antibody, proteinuria did not occur. Then they took mice. They wanted to show here that it was the Supar in circulation that was the main culprit, because patients have high Supar in circulation. So they took up mice that were knockout for Supar, so they don't have any Supar, and infused them with Supar. And you can see here that the Supar was localized to the glomerulus, and when they stained the glomerulus with AP5, they showed that AP5 was in the capillary in the podocytes. This red here, this is a specific stain for podocyte. So you see the combination of red and green is occurring in the capillary wall in the area of the podocytes. And these are further experiments where they took mice, regular mice, wild-type mice, removed the kidney, and then put a kidney from a mouse that was knocked out for Supar, did not have any Supar. And again, they show that, in fact, when they treated this mice with LPS, which releases Supar, that the food processes could be effaced. Now, this is one of the last experiments. I think this is to show, in fact, that chronic therapy can produce FSGS in the mice. These are mice engineered to have high Supar expression, so they have high level of Supar. One group of mice, as they were exposed to this high level, continuous high level of Supar, developed proteinuria. The other group of mice that did not develop proteinuria were mice that had mutation in the beta-3, so Supar could not bind to the beta-3. And these mice remained non-proteinuric. And comparing the histology, those who had the mutation, their glomerulus continued to be normal, while the other ones that did not have the mutation, who were exposed to prolonged Supar levels could react to it, develop FSGS. And basically, this shows that, again, chronic administration of the antibody could prevent these lesions. So putting it all together, basically, if we look at the capillary wall and the podocytes require sort of a balance of the various three GTPases to remain normal and have these delicate food processes. If there is increased activity or decreased activity leading either to hypomotility or hypermotility, either will result in abnormal food processes, either detachment or effacement or both. And when we use drugs like steroids and cyclosporin, we're trying to reestablish the levels of ROA, ROA, which is the GTPase, that is probably the basal rate of ROA expression, are the one most important in keeping the podocyte structure normal. Now, why am I showing you this picture from a ballpark? And this is Ryo Hiroshi. So when this article came out, I started looking around for ways to get a grant to develop an antibody to Supar. So Ryo went to actually a high school game, and next to him was sitting the patent officer from UCSF, who told him that this fellow here, Charles Craig, a PhD at Mission Bay, had a patent for an antibody to Supar. And the reason why he was pursuing Supar, he was interested in its potential effect as anti-metastatic for breast cancer. There were some concern that the antibody would have some immunosuppressive effect. So when I heard this, obviously, I heard it on Friday. Monday, I was on the phone with him. And so he got excited, and I was excited, and we put a grant through an institute at UC called CTI, Center for Therapeutic Innovation, and we got a grant, and so we started to study our own patients. And so one of the first requests from the group of the CTI was that we reproduce the data of Pfizer. So we got all our patients that had FSGS, recurrent FSGS. We studied them here. I'll show you a better picture. So this is the riser data showing recurrent much higher than recurrent. In our hand, we could not see as much of a separation. We have probably as many patients, and now we have more. In fact, the two highest patients with SUPAR were in the non-recurrent. Both of these patients actually had humor rejection. But still, we were a tiny bit put off by this data. Now, if we remove those two, we did see a statistical difference between the two, but, you know, obviously there's still a fair amount of overlap. The only change, the only difference we found between recurrent patients with high SUPAR was that those who recurred and had the highest level of SUPAR lost their kidneys, while these patients with plasmapheresis, we could actually remit their FSGS. So now we're going a tiny bit further. As I told you, SUPAR is made up of three domains, and the ELISA antibody, incidentally, we use the same ELISA from the same company that the Nature Medicine article reported. However, SUPAR can circulate as a complete protein or as separate domains, as D1 or D2 and D3. And so now we have developed separate antibodies to run ELISA separately on these, on D1 and D2 and D3, because possibly D2 is the one that binds to the beta-3 integrin and maybe the pathogenetic one. So we're pursuing this. Now, I'm showing you this because this is the latest finding from collaborating with Zoltan. We wanted to, in fact, see whether the AP5 staining, which denotes activation of the beta-3 integrin by SUPAR, whether we could demonstrate it in our patients. So this is a protocol biopsy at 6 months. The glomerular shows no staining. This is a native kidney with FSGS, and as you can see, the green staining in the capillary wall looks very nice. This is a patient with a recurrent focal, and we show, again, staining in the capillary wall, meaning that the beta-3 integrin was activated. And this is a patient with native kidney minimal change, not showing the beta-3 integrin activation. So in conclusion, we raised more questions than we answered. So the issue is really, what is the role of SUPAR as a biomarker and as a target for therapy? Is SUPAR the only permeability factor, or maybe one of many, and that's why we don't find big differences between the group? And since we have a human antibody already, should we proceed with a small pilot study? So it's more complicated. It reminds me of Churchill saying, this is not the end, this is not even the beginning of the end, but perhaps it's the end of the beginning, and that's what we hope it is. So these are all the people that have really done a lot of work for this project. Charles Craig is, of course, our local luminary on SUPAR. This was his PhD graduate who worked in his lab. Of course, you know Zoltan Lasix, our pathologist. Rachel Groth works with CTI. These two are PhD that are visiting Dr. Charles Craig's lab, and they're producing the antibody to the various domains. And, of course, all this was supported by a grant from the Center for Therapeutic Innovation. So finally, I want to ask your help. As you know, I'm interested in recurrent focal, but the only way to, you know, get some traction with companies is to try to do studies with native kidney. So we participated in one study in native kidney with an antibody called frelizumab that we published in KI for the treatment of native kidney FSGS. This is an anti-TGF beta antibody, and it's important because TGF beta can modulate matrix production, and TGF beta has been recognized as a key player in glomerular podocyte and the progression of disease in experimental models of FSGS. So we hope that frelizumab can interrupt the injury to the podocyte and the injury to the progression of FSGS and fibrosis. Now, unlike SUPAR, this basically deals with the injury pathway. I think SUPAR ultimately may be a preferred therapy if it's proven to be correct, because it actually blocks the disease at its outset. And so, but it may be that at some point, both combination may be required. to block the initial insult and to block the pathway for injury. So if you have patients with native kidney disease who have FSGS, who have failed steroids, who have a GFR greater than 30 and a urine protein creatinine of 3 or greater, we would love to talk to them and tell them about our research. Andrea Cantor is our research coordinator, who's done a fabulous job, and this is her number. Or you can call me at 353-1322. Many of you know my cell phone, and I'll be happy, of course, to talk to the patient and explain to them our protocol. We already actually got 2 patients that were referred for the study, and both of them have already gotten the first dose of the antibody. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. Happy to answer questions. Yes. Yeah. Yes, and clearly it does play a role in African American. The question is APOL1 gene polymorphism that has been reported to be associated with glomerular disease, FSGS actually, in African American. It's important. I don't know whether it does play a role in patients with recurrent focal. This may be one of the separate entities within the variability of the pathogenesis of FSGS. In general, blacks have a lower recurrence rate than Caucasian with FSGS. We found this in our first article many years ago, and other people have reported the same thing. Well, nobody has looked at that. We haven't looked at that, and I haven't seen any large studies in African American to see, in fact, whether SUPAR is actually increased in this group of patients. But I'm sure this is going to be done, because SUPAR now it's the hot topic in FSGS, and there have been many reports about SUPAR that have not confirmed the initial studies by Reiser. So it's this whole issue of SUPAR is still up in the air. Again, our findings do not necessarily confirm his work, but, you know, I think we have to do more work in this area.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.